Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So, you want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall, rock-climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So, whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Performing Arts, a podcast from the New Books Network. My name is Andy Boyd. Today on the program, I'm talking with Andy Bragan about his new book that includes the plays This Is My Office and Notes on My Mother's Decline. Andy, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So I thought as a first question I might ask, I feel like sometimes I do this podcast just so that I can ask as many people as possible this question. And the question is, what was it like studying playwriting with Maria Irene Fornes?
That is a wonderful question. And I had the privilege of having a number of really wonderful teachers. And Fornes I first studied with down in Taxco, Mexico. That was the first time I'd met her. And it was 1998. And that was pretty mind-blowing. She... her energy is wonderful. Her challenges to you are wonderful. She turns plays inside out in an amazing way. And that workshop was really special because both because she was teaching it, because a lot of writers who I've, you know, remained very close to were at it too, including Ken Preston Ninzi, Sarah Rule, Jorge Ignacio Cortinas, and Brooke Berman, among others. And we've all remained in our lives. I think subsequently I took playwriting via the Women's Project with Fornes in New York. And she had some, along with her visualization exercises, she did a lot of fun things. Like she just loved the idea of play. We had a moment where we built a little box for ourselves, a little shoebox. I think I used an old box and sort of performed our plays with little figures, doing a scene of our play. We're moving them around within that. So she was always thinking visually and creatively, and I found it really inspiring.
Do you think visually when you write?
I don't as much. I guess a little bit. I think mostly, in terms of setting, I think a lot about where a play is set. Mm-hmm. And once I've set that in place, sometimes I have it in maybe subconsciously in my brain. And then I hear voices and what those voices are. But definitely, I mean, I think both of these plays were coming out of locations. So that, but the plays that are in this book, but many other plays too. I've set plays on tennis courts, on public playgrounds. So I guess I'm thinking visually in a sense of giving myself a landscape to work within. Whether I'm specifically thinking about it in the moment of writing, it's still always there.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense. So the locations in these plays are really, really very clearly a part of why they're plays in a way. You know, I mean, I feel like any kind of the first play is essentially a one person show, and the second one is a two person show. And whenever you have something that's that minimal, one of the questions is like, why is this a play rather than, you know, like just a straight memoir? And I feel like the setting is a lot of the reason for that. That the fact that you're saying these words in places that are redolent of the locations you're talking about seem like a big part of that answer. Is that part of how you'd answer that question?
Absolutely. And I think especially with the first one, This Is My Office, that came very directly out of, because that play plays with truth and fiction, but in terms of where it started, I had this residency with the Lower Manhattan Cultural Council, and it was in this enormous floor through empty space. And as I was writing it, I would literally wander the space and write, imagine different sections set in different parts of it. So it was in a way written with this space that is now gone in mind. So I had a very physical sense of it. And of course, Notes of My Mother's Decline takes place pretty much in terms of this sort of central emotional space of it entirely in my late mother's bedroom. So that's another place I had very deeply inside me as I was writing.
Mm-hmm. One of the things I love about This Is My Office is that it so captures a feeling I've always had whenever I've had an office job, which I currently do, which is that I'm kind of pretending to have an office job. And like, I'm just sort of like going through the motions and like getting my little coffee and sending my little emails. And I always wonder, like, do people who have done this for longer feel like they're actually doing an office job? Or does everybody feel like they're pretending? And I feel like that's part of what that play is about.
That's very interesting to me because I haven't had a lot of office jobs, but I certainly have clearly, as I think is clear in the play, an emotional connection to offices from my father and having visited him at his office.
Mm-hmm.
But I've worked at various things that are similar to offices, but I haven't really spent that much time in them, to tell you the truth.
Mm-hmm.
There is something I do wonder, and I was maybe wondering it in that space, what do people do all day? And is it so demanding at every given moment? And what is downtime and not downtime? And it is confusing to me. I mean, working for myself, I certainly waste as much time as anyone else, but it's on me. It's not on anyone else's time or dime.
Right. And when you're in an office, there's certain ways you're allowed to waste time and other ways you're not allowed to waste time. Like you can scroll on Twitter for an hour, but if you like pulled out a book and read for an hour, that would be sort of unacceptable. I've always kind of wondered why those decisions get made the way they do.
That's quite interesting. And I realized I did. I was a member of a place called the Writer's Room for a while.
Oh, sure.
A bunch of writers. And I really love it there, but I did feel, even though no one was enforcing anything, I did feel a certain obligation, maybe because of all the other writers tapping away in there, to be focused and to not waste time. So there is a sense of also, I think it was also the experience of being in an office that was both a little bit social and not social. In other words, we weren't really talking to each other, but we were all in the same space together. Maybe it's the odd fellowship of the office that's interesting to me too.
There's also a great sort of rhapsody for the storeroom, which you write about being a very sort of attractive place to you as a child. What do you think was so exciting to you about the office storeroom with all the paper and paper clips and binders and stuff?
Yeah, I mean, I think I remember having those materials around, and I also ran a little home-based business in my 20s, this little travel business. So I'd always be ordering various supplies. So I had a sort of relationship to these random supplies and binders. I guess I had maybe it was through my mother actually at her office that I would get access to certain things. She worked as a lecturer at Baruch College, and I'd have access to various rubber bands there as much as anywhere. But yeah, those materials for a kid, and I see my own child when she gets into these things, they get kind of interesting to her, scissors and rubber bands and all of that. I don't know, they hold a kind of mystique of some other life. And maybe as a child, you can imagine playing and being something through that.
Mm-hmm. I think one of the things about it for a child is that they're so similar to, I mean, in some ways, they're the exact same as the things that you play with when you're like making crafts as a kid. So you can sort of imagine, oh, like what I do at daycare with the scissors, maybe that's what mom's doing all day at the office, or dad's doing all day at the office. So it maybe closes the distance between the office and the child's experience in some way.
Yeah, I think it makes a lot of sense, in the sense that we do want to understand in some way what our parents are and want to relate it to ourselves. And that weird, I think the plays are both very interested in perspective. In other words, if you're a small person and you're looking up at an adult, you don't really understand them, but you understand certain things very deeply, and certain things are rather confusing. I mean, that sort of, I guess the idea visually for me is like reminding myself of what it was like to ride in an elevator when you were 4 feet tall and you were surrounded by all these people who were much bigger. In some sense, the perspective of the plays, especially when it's from the child's perspective, is coming from that.
Mm-hmm. These are both plays that deal with your own process of mourning. This is My Office kind of centers around your relationship with your father and Notes on My Mother's Decline, obviously your mother. How much distance in time did you have from their deaths before you started writing each of these plays?
Well, different distances, in fact. This is My Office. My father died in November 2007. And I believe I started writing some scenes of This is My Office late in 2009 into 2010. So I had a couple of years there, and it was still fresh in some ways, but it wasn't immediate. Mm-hmm. And Notes of My Mother's Decline, I'd say a more complicated relationship with my mother in a sense. And her decline was, my father was sick very briefly, and it was sort of shocking and sudden. He passed away at 71, which is not young, but felt early to me. My mother had a lengthy decline, and my entry into Notes My Mother's Decline was I had seen This Is My Office produced in 2013 by the Play Company in late 2013. And that December, I just started writing a scene or two of Notes My Mother's Decline at the very beginning. I think I had my friend and a director I very much admire, Daniel Fish, had come to see This Is My Office and really liked it. And so in some ways I wanted to write something with Daniel in mind, almost that question, what would Daniel Fish do? Mm-hmm. And so I
not
kind
a bad
of,
question.
I think it's a great question. I think
great question to start a play for.
Because he's a brilliant director and he questions everything. He takes nothing for granted. So I think as a writer, how do you enter and take nothing for granted in that way? Mm-hmm. And so I started that play. I started Notes My Mother's Decline at the end of 2013, beginning of 2014. My mother was declining, but she was still very much a force. And I wrote a lot of it, and I didn't talk to her about it. And her decline accelerated over those years. Mm. And she passed away in, I guess it was late 2017. And I had written most of the play or earlier version of it, but I couldn't end it. And I actually wrote the last scene, the dialogue scene, on a single sitting, maybe 3 months after she died in 2018, because I couldn't figure out the ending. I had other endings in mind. I probably had my own anger to reckon with and my own. I was in the middle of it in her decline and her caretaking. So I think I needed to have a softer ending and a more generous ending. And I couldn't have gotten there until after she died.
Mm-hmm. One difference between the two plays that maybe comes through more reading them than it would seeing them staged is that the character in This Is My Office is named Andy Bragan, but the character in Notes on My Mother's Decline is named Son. Why did you make that choice? Why did you decide to explicitly name the character after yourself in the first play? And why did you not do that in the second one?
That's an interesting question. I think that the first one, the sort of non-generous answer to myself was that it seemed clever, but I think it was more than that. I think it was because it was so specifically about that space or something that it felt like I wanted to place myself in. I actually don't know the answer to that. For the second one, they just felt, maybe it was from to give myself some distance from it. I'm not sure.
Right. I mean, that's sort of why I asked the question, because I thought it was interesting that I feel like so much less distance between you and your mother in Notes on My Mother's Decline than there is between you and your father in This Is My Office. So the decision to name the character in Notes on My Mother's Decline, Son, does seem like a way to kind of put some distance there that's not there in the material. I mean, I feel like the intuitive choice would be to switch them and to have Sun be the character in This Is My Office and Andy Bragan be the character in Notes on My Mother's Decline. So I was interested that you didn't do that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that I'm not even sure I thought about it. I think it was intuitive. I also think that I don't even list characters in Notes My Mother's Decline for most of it. And I think Sarah Ruland, her foreword, was really smart about this and pointing out that the characters were so entwined that they didn't even get that sort of distance. Mm-hmm. And whatever it was, I mean, when I started Notes, I started the beginning of the play, I wrote a couple pages of dialogue. And then I realized, and it was partly related to the "What would Daniel Fish do?" question, I removed all of the Sun's dialogue from that section, and I sort of found the style of what the play was through that. That a conventional dialogue actually weirdly felt less intimate in some way than the one-sided part.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that kind of one-sidedness of the mother character really does give you, it's almost like it bypasses sense, right? It bypasses like making these logical connections, and you get such a sort of strong dose of just her language and her character without it being in the context of, you know, pursuing an objective or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the power of that character for the Sun and for me at various points was really serious. And the dialogue, it would fall almost into bickering. And maybe I'm being generous to Sun by not showing his moments of petulance, though I think they're implied in the play. Yeah, there's something about trying to capture a person too. And I remember in some earlier writing, probably before I started that play, or maybe during it at some point, I started, you know, trying to think about my mother and like writing just little snippets about each decade of her life, which had been an interesting life, and thinking about what did that look like. And I don't know if that was just for my own interest or if I was thinking about a play, but just sort of looking at it, but just thinking about this journey of this person who had grown up in Mississippi, had this really, as I've learned more since, an accident from which she nearly died in 16, spent a year in traction in a hospital in small town Mississippi, and some part of her was always there. And some part of her lived through language and lived through stories. And in that sense, giving her that language and that voice and that, you know, for better and for worse, that storytelling felt like both a sort of a capturing and hopefully a gift to some part of her.
Was her storytelling part of what inspired you to become a writer?
I think so. I had a 35th birthday party at Kanji Village with a few of my friends that she wanted to host. And we were in one of those group rooms. And I think a friend of mine who hadn't known her before said, now I, you know, having met her, having seen her holding court at my birthday party, said, now I know where your plays come from and that voice. And she, I think the way she spoke and the way she approached the world and the stories of our family, in some ways, that was one of the great parts of her. One of the good parts of her was her storytelling and her ability to share that. And that's definitely something that I value and think about and is part of me. Yes.
Holding court is such an interesting phrase that you used there. I would never describe my mother as holding court. What was that? What did that mean when she did that?
Well, I think it just means that she would center things upon herself, which certainly was not something that was always pleasant to see as her son. But, you know, a cousin of mine used to call her the queen. So she would hold court at various points. She would hold court in her room, in her bedroom, and people would come in to talk with her. And she would have her things she wanted to talk about. So, I mean, holding court is problematic because you're not always listening as well as you might to other people, or you're doing it on your own terms. And that's not all she did, but definitely there was a kind of ludicrous and yet true regalness to that, which always struck me and did not always make me feel very comfortable, but it's something I can know was part of her.
Right. And there's I feel like regalness implies a certain sort of dignity and self-regard.
Yeah.
Maybe for good and for bad.
Exactly. And I think she did have a certain kind of dignity and some really good qualities in that regard. And the self-regard, I mean, to an extent, sure, I think so. But definitely a strong personality, I guess I would say. And I've been writing, you know, I've been working on a book about family history. I have sort of a checkered family history in that part of Mississippi there. And so I've been thinking about where she grew up and where she came from in terms of earlier generations. And it's very interesting to see what all that means and where her values, the good ones and the not so good ones, may have come from, and the things she reckoned with in her past and her family and the things she didn't reckon with. So it's been a big part of my writing life, a bigger part than I thought it would be. And I think with the years passing, as difficult as my mother could be, I feel some generosity towards her and recognizing that what she grew up through was not easy.
Mm-hmm. I mean, what you're describing reminds me a lot of Tennessee Williams' relationship with his mother.
Yeah, I think I know that that's something my mother certainly had a great admiration for Amanda and Blanche in a way.
That's great. Yeah. Did you ever consider playing the you character in either of these plays?
A little bit. I mean, I'm not that good, partly. I guess I did an early reading. I did a little workshop for myself, reading notes with another actor, and I felt that I wasn't really there. And I think I heard that from the director. For notes, for This Is My Office, likewise, I read parts of it. I mean, I had the opportunity we did a reading at McNally Jackson at South Street Seaport of excerpts for the book launch. And I had a chance to read that last scene with Carolyn Lagerfeld, who played Mother in the production. And that was very moving to play the scene that I invented, this kind of fantasy, and to play it. So I think I was okay at it, but to do that whole play seems rather daunting. And I'm married to an actor, and I've seen her work, and I know what it is, and I know the kind of listening and control of it. So I recognize that there are some real limitations to what I could do with it. And I have so much admiration for the performers I've worked with, David Barlow and Ari Fliakos. Mm-hmm. And of course, the many people who did workshops, they taught me so much, and they brought so much to it. And they found elements and colors that I could never have found, I think.
I used to act a little bit, and I acted through college and haven't acted since then. And the thing that I was worst at was just being present and paying attention in the moment. Like, I would always sort of like drift off in a scene and, you know, miss lines or stuff like that. What do you feel like are your weaknesses as an actor?
Ha, that's a fun question. I feel like I have all these limbs and I don't always know what to do with them.
Oh, yeah, sure.
So the sort of physical body, I think what I think is talking in an interesting way, maybe talking too fast or without variety. Mm-hmm. I do think there's a kind of emotional distance, and listening is certainly part of it. There are just so many. I mean, there are a lot of bad actors out there, let's be clear, and there are a lot of good ones, but I do think a really good actor brings all of these elements that are really, that you can only get so far with through kind of natural sort of affiliation with the part. I mean, there are those who would disagree. I mean, you could look at what Richard Maxwell is doing, where he's using non-actors for parts and trying to sort of strip away. And there is a place for that. But I certainly felt for this first production, I wanted to see it with actors. And who knows, maybe someday I'll have a chance to do it and I'll find out one way or the other. But I just have a lot of respect for actors, especially parts like these that demand such emotional being able to move from one space to another, kind of the gymnastics of the plays are pretty significant.
Mm-hmm. And the second one in particular, Notes on My Mother's Decline, is a really kind of bruising play. Like, even just reading it, I was struck by how just visceral and intense and painful it was to read. And I could imagine performing that, you know, 8 times a week when it's your life, it's maybe not the most attractive proposition.
Yeah, that doesn't sound very pleasant to me. And they were, and the intensity of what they had to put out there was pretty substantial in terms of the level of focus. And Carolyn certainly playing the mom, it took a lot out of her. And Ari, being part of Worcester Group, is used to some truly demanding physical, emotional, and mental work. And I think for him, too, it was a challenge in some good ways.
Yeah. How often did you watch these plays when they were in production?
Quite a bit. Probably it was a short run for Notes, so I was there as often as I could be. And for This Is My Office, a fair amount too, maybe a little bit less. The thing is with plays, you don't get that many productions really always, or certainly you don't get that many productions that are the productions you choose and are the way you want them to be. And I was really pleased with, you know, what we accomplished with them. These were the versions of the plays that I wanted to see. And that doesn't really happen all that often. So I really wanted to be there and enjoy it. And I think both of them had were weirdly cathartic for me in different ways. And in a way helped me get through some parts of mourning. This Is My Office ends with a kind of invitation to the audience. And we were serving donuts after every performance and chatting with the audience. And so that was rather wonderful to share. It felt like a kind of wake. And that was wonderful. And Notes, in some ways, it helped me pass through certain emotions I might not have passed through as well as I needed to beforehand, to see it, to let go of a lot of things.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
I'm not like a doctrinaire Freudian or anything, but there is like a notion in Freud that I think is interesting, which is that part of what you need to do to kind of to mourn properly is to channel the energy that you've invested into that relationship into some other thing, some other like project or activity or something. And that, you know, bad mourning happens when you just sort of bottle up that energy and continue trying to kind of make that connection with that person that's no longer there. Do you feel like that was part of what you were doing by writing these plays, sort of channeling the, you know, complicated libidinal energies that you directed towards your parents into writing and producing and watching and, you know, publishing these plays?
I think that's probably true. I think that probably I would have perhaps to continue on that, I would have sort of repressed or avoided some of the emotions. If I just said, oh, my mother's gone. Ooh, what a relief. I can get on with my life now. There have been some benefits to that, but it also would not have really been true because there's such a deep connection there. So mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that to get in there allows me, it also allows me to sort of forgive her for some of her ways and forgive myself for not being, as kind to her as I might have been along the way. So I think that part of it is to get beyond the battles of life and to accept that person who was part of your life and was imperfect and that you were imperfect with them and, yeah, to be able to let go of that. So I think that, you know, that is right fundamentally.
Mm-hmm. Were you able to have, I know there's the imagined conversation with your mother at the end of Notes on My Mother's Decline. Were you able to have any kind of a sort of, reconciliation, kind of a summing up with her in real life at all?
I think in different ways we had different things, but not entirely. I think that we had some real run-ins, and it was a really hard last few years. And sometimes I was able to be there for her, and we had some nice moments, and sometimes we couldn't see each other. So I think that we loved each other and we got on each other's nerves. And I worked very hard to put up a lot of boundaries to protect my family and protect myself. There's no clean conversation where things came together. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if I would exactly wish for that or think that's even possible. I mean, there's always unfinished business. There are always things that one would like to know, but I do know that I think she knew the fundamentals about, you know, that I loved her and I cared for my family and that we were okay. But of course, along the way, there were some real bumps.
Right.
The voice of Notes on My Mother's Decline is very different than the voice of This Is My Office. Like, This Is My Office has a tone that I would describe as sort of like, sort of arch and a bit kind of ironic and kind of showman-like, you know, there's a kind of like ha-cha-cha quality to it. Whereas Notes on My Mother's Decline is much more kind of spare and poetic and kind of cut to the bone. How did you find the voice of each of these two plays?
I think that has to do partly with changing as a writer, perhaps. Mm-hmm. This is My Office. I guess that was the tone I heard, and maybe that was how I was thinking about language and cleverness or something. Mm-hmm. I think I may be holding on to a little less with Notes My Mother's Decline, and the thing I want to get to is the core of it, the raw mm-hmm. thing.
Yeah.
And I think I love arch plays and I believe in it. And I think there's a lot of space for cleverness for that particular play. There just didn't, I think getting to the raw thing at base felt right. And I'm sure there were some moments, I think in some earlier drafts, there were some moments of cleverness and, or moments of like, commenting, and I tried to push away from that as I kept revising and cutting. So if anything, I mean, this is my office. I think, as I say in the little intro, is a kind of magic trick. And there's a kind of fun to that, of that memory. Notes is sort of, is definitely, as you say, cutting to the bone and getting to something where this character's, whatever this character is wrestling with. I mean, I wrote that also as a parent in my late 40s. I mean, the concerns of my late 30s versus my late 40s maybe feel different. I'm not sure.
Yeah, there's a line in This Is My Office where the character says something like, you know, why am I a playwright? Well, you know, I'm 40 and I'm still a playwright and I might as well keep going now. that sort of feels like that's maybe enough of a motivation to keep going at that age. But at a certain point, I mean, this is something Václav Havel talked about, that like you have your first kind of wave of inspiration as a young writer and like it's going to run out eventually and you either stop writing or you find another reason to write. Do you feel like you've gone through a similar process?
I think I've had to let go of certain things. I mean, you have two different parts to that. You have the artistic question and the career question.
Mm-hmm.
I think on the career question, I came out of graduate school, and This Is My Office carries some of that energy still, with a great deal of ambition and some sense that I should be getting somewhere, doing something in this world, that people were going to give me things. And of course, life doesn't work like that, nor should it. And I had to come to terms with sort of a certain kind of success, I guess, or lack of success, in the sense certain things didn't happen for me and certain things did. But ultimately, I think I got past that and said, I'm writing because I care about writing about what I care about. I'm not going to rely on what's coming from the outside here. I'm going to do my best not to. And just, I love writing. I love telling stories in the theater. I love making plays and I love doing this. And some of it's very personal and some of it's less personal. And this is what I do. So in a way, and it's very hard to get a play done. It's hard to know when the next play will be done, but I'm still doing it because I love it, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I got a rejection email from a publisher this week where they were like, you know, we like the play, but it's only had one production. Is there going to be a second production? We might publish it if there's a second production. And it was sort of like, do you realize how hard it is to get one like self-produced dinky little production? Like, it just seemed like such a cruel question, you know?
Yeah, it is. It's very hard. And I think people are finding ways to work in and out of institutions, but it does demand a lot. And to find a way to do it on the terms that you want to do it is important, I think. We try to find our way forward. But I think artistically, sort of trying to, whether or not a play is emotionally cutting to the bone with one's mother, there's certainly so many ways to get at things that seem important to oneself. And that can be comedy, that can be whatever it is that feels like the thing that you're doing and approaching it with great integrity, I think. And that feels like a way forward, at least.
This is like more of a personal question than like an interview question, I guess. But like, how did you, I don't know, did you feel like you've done that? And if so, how'd you do it? And if only partially, how did you partially do it? Like, how do you actually make that switch to being somebody who writes what you find interesting rather than somebody who's trying to, you know, have a play on Broadway or at Roundabout or whatever?
You know, I continue to work on it, and I definitely had some moments earlier on where I'd put on a play and I would think it would lead to certain things and it might not. I think it was just a gradual experience of trying to let go, and I'm not perfect at it, and I certainly have desires and ambitions like everyone else, but I feel as if it just made me unhappy to really always be thinking about the next thing in terms of what someone's going to do for me. And I've seen it make some other people I know unhappy, and it certainly was not great for, you know, my personal life either to carry that kind of energy with me. So I just think about the moments that I'm really enjoying making theater. And also knowing that some writers I really respect who also are, you know, struggling, but doing it for really pure reasons. And maybe struggling is not the right word, because they're just writing and they're writing beautiful plays. I'm in a writer's group, and one of the writers was writing a play, and he's a writer who's been done, you know, across the country off Broadway. And it was this big play. And he's like, you know, no one's going to do this play right now, but I'm writing it for you, for this group. And this is during COVID. So we're meeting on Zoom every week. And he would read, we would read these 20 beautiful pages. And I was deeply inspired by that. And that idea, I think that, you know, Lewis Hyde talks about in The Gift. I know Sarah Rules referred to it a lot at various points. This idea of writing a play as a gift for someone, as opposed to saying, this is a transaction I need to get value from. I want to write this as a gift, and it's something that can be shared. So, of course, we all want to share our work. We want to see it on the stage. And that's something I continue to fight for. But the reward of something, you know, external, while I would want it, I can't center my life on it.
Yeah. That's a great answer. Yeah. I want to know, so these plays are both in different ways, but I would say both are just incredibly personal plays and divulge a lot of painful factual, or, you know, presumably factual information about you and your parents and your relationship to your parents and things that happened to them and, you know, the way you grew up. And I'm not that kind of writer at all. I don't write about myself. I'm like not interested in myself. So I wonder, just like, was that hard for you to expose yourself so directly in front of a bunch of strangers by writing these plays?
It didn't feel that hard, I guess. And I hadn't done that with many plays before that, at least not directly, I don't think. I mean, there are things that I, in a way, you can't tell people what's true and what's not true, and it doesn't really matter. Some fundamentals are true. And even if some facts are not,
And I should say, like, in This Is My Office, there's stuff that clearly didn't happen because it's sort of like absurd, you know, like there's like you start sleeping in the office that you've been given at this residency, which I assume you didn't actually do. And, you know, so I feel like you do find ways within these plays to kind of landmark, this is made up, this is maybe true. So, yeah.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. And I think with This in My Office, I did sort of lean into a slightly more sad sack version of myself at that point. And that was, you know, that was for a dramatic interest. No, I feel okay with that. I mean, I feel that, you know, looking at different kinds of art, there are many different ways that people expose themselves. And we're always engaging as writers, I think, with our fantasies and our nightmares. And there are just different ways that we engage with it or disguise with it. In some ways, maybe my choice here is to kind of hide in plain sight. And other writers have other methods for engaging with things they care about.
Could I ask you what you're working on these days, or, you know, if you're working on anything these days?
Sure. I'm working on a couple things. I have a play called To the Playground, which is about adults on the playground and their sort of combination of obsessions with the banal and the existential, sort of a combination of, you know, concerns with, be it potty training or global climate change or whatever, and how those things kind of end up at the same register. So that's a play I've worked on some. And I'm working on this book, as I mentioned briefly, about my extended family from Mississippi. My mother's side of the family made me live up my father's side. Four generations ago, my great-great-grandfather, my mother's side, was an enslaver who fought at Gettysburg and was in the Confederate state legislature. And I have some diaries. I have some wills. Wow. I have a lot of material from back then and a lot of research I've been doing to sort of look at the sort of how the past and the present connects. And I'm a native New Yorker, so I have a great deal of distance from Mississippi. And yet I'm looking at, you know, how they were back then, how I am in my own life. So it's a pretty, I guess it's a kind of memoir slash nonfiction. Maybe I'll write a play eventually from it. But right now I'm trying to write a book.
Great. I'd like to ask you too, you mentioned being a parent, and it sounds like that's something that you're looking at in your current writing. Do you feel like there are things that you do as a parent that you've either consciously or unconsciously taken from how your parents acted towards you?
Yes, for sure. I think there are some great things my parents did and some not so great things, but I certainly am aware of the freedom I had as a kid, and that was part of the 1970s, where I was able to sort of walk to school by myself starting at age 8. That's important to me, to give my kid a certain amount of freedom. She's not wanting to take as much of it just yet, but she's taking parts of it. No, I think that one thing that my family always did was value books and reading, and that's something that my mother gave me and my father gave me. So I think both, you know, via example, because my wife and I read all the time, and also because we're engaged with stories with our daughter in deep ways, both reading to her and just talking about them, because she reads to herself mostly now. Those values, that sort of intellectual, the value of creativity and intellect and all of that is really central. And I think my parents, were they here, would recognize and appreciate that.
Well, Andy Bragan, thanks so much for being on New Books in Performing Arts to talk about your new book. I really enjoyed reading these two plays, and I really enjoyed getting to talk with you about them.
Thank you, Andy. It was a real pleasure. Have a wonderful day.